and put up his horse himself, unsaddled him and put on the halter, while the servant girl brought a bundle of straw and threw it as best she could into the manger. To replace Natazi, who left Tostes shedding torrents of tears, Emma took into her service a young girl of 14, an orphan with a sweet face. She forbade her wearing cotton caps, taught her to address her in the third person, to bring a glass of water on a plate, to knock before coming into a room, to iron, starch, and to dress her, wanted to make a lady's maid of her. The new servant obeyed without a murmur, so as not to be sent away, and, as Madame usually left the key in the sideboard, Félicité every evening took a small supply of sugar that she ate alone in her bed after she had said her prayers. Sometimes in the afternoon she went to chat with the postillions. Madame was in her room upstairs. She had bought herself a blotting-book, writing-case, penholder, and envelopes, although she had no one to write to. She dusted her what-not, looked at herself in the glass, picked up a book, and then, dreaming between the lines, let it drop on her knees. She longed to travel or to go back to her convent. She wished at the same time to die and to live in Paris. Charles, in snow and rain, trotted across country. He ate omelettes on farmhouse tables, poked his arm into damp beds, received the tepid spurt of bloodlettings in his face, listened to death rattles, examined basins, turned over a good deal of dirty linen. But every evening he found a blazing fire, his dinner ready, easy chairs, and a well-dressed woman, charming with an odour of freshness, though no one could say whence the perfume came, or if it were not her skin that made odorous her chemise. She charmed him by numerous attentions. Now it was some new way of arranging paper sconces for the candles, a flounce that she altered on her gown, or an extraordinary name for some very simple dish that the servant had spoilt, but that Charles swallowed with pleasure to the last mouthful. At Rouen she saw some ladies who wore a bunch of charms on their watch-chains. She bought some charms. She wanted for her mantelpiece two large blue glass vases, and some time after an ivory nécessaire with a silver gilt thimble. The less Charles understood these refinements, the more they seduced him. They added something to the pleasure of the senses and to the comfort of his fireside. It was like a golden dust sanding all along the narrow path of his life. He was well, looked well. His reputation was firmly established. The country folk loved him because he was not proud. He petted the children, never went to the public house, and moreover his morals inspired confidence. He was specially successful with catarrhs and chest complaints. Being much afraid of killing his patients, Charles in fact only prescribed sedatives, from time to time an emetic, a foot bath, or leeches. It was not that he was afraid of surgery. He bled people copiously like horses, and for the taking out of teeth he had the devil's own wrist. Finally, to keep up with the times, he took in La Ruche Medicale, a new journal whose prospectus had been sent him. He read it a little after dinner, but in about 5 minutes the warmth of the room, added to the effect of his dinner, sent him to sleep, and he sat there, his chin on his two hands and his hair spreading like a mane to the foot of the lamp. Emma looked at him and shrugged her shoulders. Why, at least, was not her husband one of those men of taciturn passions who work at their books all night, and at last, when about 60, the age of rheumatism sets in, wear a string of orders on their ill-fitting black coat? She could have wished this name of Bovary, which was hers, had been illustrious, to see it displayed at the booksellers, repeated in the newspapers, known to all France. But Charles had no ambition. An Yvetot doctor, whom he had lately met in consultation, had somewhat humiliated him at the very bedside of the patient before the assembled relatives. When, in the evening, Charles told her this anecdote, Emma inveighed loudly against his colleague. Charles was much touched. He kissed her forehead with a tear in his eyes. But she was angered with shame. She felt a wild desire to strike him. She went to open the window in the passage and breathed in the fresh air to calm herself. "What a man! What a man!" she said in a low voice, biting her lips. Besides, she was becoming more irritated with him. As he grew older, his manner grew heavier. At dessert, he cut the corks of the empty bottles. After eating, he cleaned his teeth with his tongue. In taking soup he made a gurgling noise with every spoonful. And as he was getting fatter, the puffed-out cheeks seemed to push the eyes, always small, up to the temples. Sometimes Emma tucked the red borders of his undervest into his waistcoat, rearranged his cravat, and threw away the dirty gloves he was going to put on. And this was not, as he fancied, for himself. It was for herself, by a diffusion of egotism, of nervous irritation. Sometimes, too, she told him of what she had read, such as a passage in a novel, of a new play, or an anecdote of the upper ten that she had seen in a feuilleton. For after all, Charles was something, an ever-open ear, an ever-ready approbation. She confided many a thing to her greyhound. She would have done so to the logs in the fireplace, or to the pendulum of the clock. At bottom of her heart, however, she was waiting for something to happen. Like shipwrecked sailors, she turned despairing eyes upon the solitude of her life, seeking afar off some white sail in the mists of the horizon. She did not know what this chance would be, what wind would bring it her, towards what shore it would drive her, if it would be a shallop or a three-decker, laden with anguish or full of bliss to the portholes. But each morning, as she awoke, she hoped it would come that day. She listened to every sound, sprang up with a start, wondered that it did not come. Then, at sunset, always more saddened, she longed for the morrow. Spring came round. With the first warm weather, when the pear trees began to blossom, she suffered from dyspnea. From the beginning of July, she counted how many weeks there were to October, thinking that perhaps the Marquis d'Andervilliers would give another ball at Vaubyessard. But all September passed without letters or visits. After the ennui of this disappointment, her heart once more remained empty, and then the same series of days recommenced. So now they would thus follow one another, always the same, immovable and bringing nothing. Other lives, however flat, had at least the chance of some event. One adventure sometimes brought with it infinite consequences, and the scene changed. But nothing happened to her. God had willed it so. The future was a dark corridor with its door at the end shut fast. She gave up music. What was the good of playing? Who would hear her? Since she could never, in a velvet gown with short sleeves, striking with her light fingers the ivory keys of an Erard at a concert, feel the murmur of ecstasy envelop her like a breeze, it was not worth while boring herself with practising. Her drawing cardboard and her embroidery she left in the cupboard. What was the good? What was the good? Sewing irritated her. "I have read everything," she said to herself. And she sat there making the tongs red hot or looking at the rain falling. How sad she was on Sundays when Vespers sounded. She listened with dull attention to each stroke of the cracked bell. A cat, slowly walking over some roof, put up his back in the pale rays of the sun. The wind on the high road blew up clouds of dust. Afar off a dog sometimes howled, and the bell, keeping time, continued its monotonous ringing that died away over the fields. But the people came out from church, the women in waxed clogs, the peasants in new blouses, the little bare-headed children skipping along in front of them, all were going home. And till nightfall, five or six men, always the same, stayed playing at corks in front of the large door of the inn. The winter was severe. The windows every morning were covered with rime, and the light shining through them, dim as though ground glass, sometimes did not change the whole day long. At 4 o'clock the lamp had to be lighted. On fine days she went down into the garden. The dew had left on the cabbages a silver lace with long transparent threads spreading from one to the other. No birds were to be heard. Everything seemed asleep, the espalier covered with straw, and the vine like a great sick serpent under the coping of the wall, along which, on drawing near, one saw the many-footed woodlice crawling. Under the spruce by the hedgerow, the curé in the three-cornered hat reading his breviary had lost his right foot, and the very plaster, scaling off with the frost, had left white scabs on his face. Then she went up again, shut her door, put on coals, and fainting with the heat of the hearth, felt her boredom weigh more heavily than ever. She would have liked to go down and talk to the servant, but a sense of shame restrained her. Every day at the same time, the schoolmaster in a black skullcap opened the shutters of his house, and the rural policeman, wearing his sabre over his blouse, passed by. Night and morning, the post-horses, three by three, crossed the street to water at the pond. From time to time, the bell of a public-house door rang, and when it was windy, one could hear the little brass basins that served as signs for the hairdresser's shop creaking on their two rods. This shop had as decoration an old engraving of a fashion plate stuck against a window-pane and the wax bust of a woman with yellow hair. He too, the hairdresser, lamented his wasted calling, his hopeless future, and dreaming of some shop in a big town, at Rouen, for example, overlooking the harbour near the theatre, he walked up and down all day from the Mairie to the church, sombre and waiting for customers. When Madame Bovary looked up, she always saw him there like a sentinel on duty, with his skullcap over his ears and his vest of lasting. Sometimes in the afternoon, outside the window of her room, the head of a man appeared, a swarthy head with black whiskers, smiling slowly with a broad, gentle smile that showed his white teeth. A waltz immediately began. And on the organ in a little drawing-room, dancers the size of a finger, women in pink turbans, Tyroleans in jackets, monkeys in frock-coats, gentlemen in knee-breeches, turned and turned between the sofas, the consoles, multiplied in the bits of looking-glass, held together at their corners by a piece of gold paper. The man turned his handle, looking to the right and left and up at the windows. Now and again, while he shot out a long squirt of brown saliva against the milestone, with his knee he raised his instrument, whose hard straps tired his shoulder. And now, doleful and drawling, or gay and hurried, the music escaped from the box, droning through a curtain of pink taffeta under a brass claw in arabesque. There were airs played in other places at the theatres, sung in drawing-rooms, danced to at night under lighted lustres. Echoes of the world that reached even to Emma. Endless sarabands ran through her head, and like an Indian dancing girl on the flowers of a carpet, her thoughts leapt with the notes, swung from dream to dream, from sadness to sadness. When the man had caught some coppers in his cap, he drew down an old cover of blue cloth, hitched his organ onto his back, and went off with a heavy tread. She watched him going. But it was above all the meal times that were unbearable to her. In this small room on the ground floor, with its smoking stove, its creaking door, the walls that sweated, the damp flags, all the bitterness in life seemed served up on her plate, and with the smoke of the boiled beef there rose from her secret soul whiffs of sickliness. Charles was a slow eater. She played with a few nuts, or leaning on her elbow, amused herself with drawing lines along the oilcloth table cover with the point of her knife. She now let everything in her household take care of itself, and Madame Bovary Senior, when she came to spend part of Lent at Tosters, was much surprised at the change. She, who was formerly so careful, so dainty, now passed whole days without dressing, wore grey cotton stockings and burnt tallow candles. She kept saying they must be economical since they were not rich, adding that she was very contented, very happy, that Tosters pleased her very much, with other speeches that closed the mouth of her mother-in-law. Besides, Emma no longer seemed inclined to follow her advice. Once, even, Madame Bovary having thought fit to maintain that mistresses ought to keep an eye on the religion of their servants, she had answered with so angry a look and so cold a smile that the good woman did not try it on again. Emma was growing difficile, capricious. She ordered dishes for herself, then she did not touch them. One day drank only pure milk, and the next cups of tea by the dozen. Often she persisted in not going out, then, stifling, threw open the windows and put on light dresses. After she had well scolded her servant, she gave her presents, or sent her out to see neighbours, just as she sometimes threw beggars all the silver in her purse, although she was by no means tender-hearted or easily accessible to the feelings of others, like most country-bred people, who always retain in their souls something of the horny hardness of the paternal hands. Toward the end of February, old Rouault, in memory of his cure, himself brought his son-in-law a superb turkey and stayed 3 days at Tosters. Charles, being with his patients, Emma kept him company. He smoked in the room, spat on the fire-dogs, talked farming, calves, cows, poultry, and municipal council, so that when he left she closed the door on him with a feeling of satisfaction that surprised even herself. Moreover, she no longer concealed her contempt for anything or anybody, and at times she set herself to express singular opinions, finding fault with that which others approved, and approving things perverse and immoral, all of which made her husband open his eyes widely. Would this misery last for ever? Would she never issue from it? Yet she was as good as all the women who were living happily. She had seen duchesses at Vaubyessard with clumsier waists and commoner ways, and she execrated the injustice of God. She leant her head against the walls to weep. She envied lives of stir, longed for masked balls, for violent pleasures, with all the wildness that she did not know, but that these must surely yield. She grew pale and suffered from palpitations of the heart. Charles prescribed valerian and camphor baths. Everything that was tried only seemed to irritate her the more. On certain days she chattered with feverish rapidity, and this overexcitement was suddenly followed by a state of torpor, in which she remained without speaking, without moving. What then revived her was pouring a bottle of eau de cologne over her arms. As she was constantly complaining about Tostes, Charles fancied that her illness was no doubt due to some local cause, and, fixing on this idea, began to think seriously of setting up elsewhere. From that moment she drank vinegar, contracted a sharp little cough, and completely lost her appetite. It cost Charles much to give up Tostes after living there 4 years, and when he was beginning to get on there. Yet, if it must be, he took her to Rouen to see his old master. It was a nervous complaint. Change of air was needed. After looking about him on this side and on that, Charles learned that in the Neufchâtel arrondissement there was a considerable market town called Yonville-l'Abbaye, whose doctor, a Polish refugee, had decamped a week before. Then he wrote to the chemist of the place to ask the number of the population, the distance from the nearest doctor, what his predecessor had made a year, and so forth. And the answer being satisfactory, he made up his mind to move towards the spring, if Emma's health did not improve. One day, when, in view of her departure, she was tidying a drawer, something pricked her finger. It was a wire of her wedding bouquet. The orange blossoms were yellow with dust, and the silver-bordered satin ribbons frayed at the edges. She threw it into the fire. It flared up more quickly than dry straw. Then it was like a red bush in the cinders, slowly devoured. She watched it burn. The little pasteboard berries burst, the wire twisted, the gold lace melted, and the shrivelled paper corollas, fluttering like black butterflies at the back of the stove, at last flew up the chimney. When they left Tostes in the month of March, Madame Bovary was pregnant. Part 2. Chapter 1. Yonville-l'Abbaye, so-called from an old Capuchin abbey of which not even the ruins remain, is a market town 24 miles from Rouen, between the Abbeville and Beauvais roads, at the foot of a valley watered by the Rieule, a little river that runs into the Andelle, after turning 3 water mills near its mouth, where there are a few trout that the lads amuse themselves by fishing for on Sundays. We leave the high road at La Boissière and keep straight on to the top of the Leur Hill, whence the valley is seen. The river that runs through it makes of it, as it were, 2 regions with distinct physiognomies. All on the left is pasture land, all on the right arable. The meadow stretches under a bulge of low hills to join at the back with the pasture land of the Bray country, while on the eastern side the plain, gently rising, broadens out, showing, as far as I can follow, its blonde cornfields. The water, flowing by the grass, divides with a white line the colour of the roads and of the plains, and the country is like a great unfolded mantle, with a green velvet cape, bordered with a fringe of silver. Before us, on the verge of the horizon, lie the oaks of the forest of Argueil, with the steeps of the Saint-Jean hills, scarred from top to bottom with red irregular lines. They are rain tracks, and these brick tones, standing out in narrow streaks against the grey colour of the mountain, are due to the quantity of iron springs that flow beyond in the neighbouring country. Here we are on the confines of Normandy, Picardy, and the Île-de-France, a bastard land whose language is without accent as its landscape is without character. It is there that they make the worst Neufchâtel cheeses of all the arrondissement. And on the other hand, farming is costly, because so much manure is needed to enrich this friable soil full of sand and flints. Up to 1835, there was no practicable road for getting to Yonville, but about this time a crossroad was made, which joins that of Abbeville to that of Amiens, and is occasionally used by the Rouen wagoners on their way to Flanders. Yonville-l'Abbaye has remained stationary in spite of its new outlet. Instead of improving the soil, they persist in keeping up the pasture lands, however depreciated they may be in value, and the lazy borough, growing away from the plain, has naturally spread riverwards. It is seen from afar, sprawling along the banks, like a cowherd taking a siesta by the waterside. At the foot of the hill beyond the bridge begins a roadway, planted with young aspens, that leads in a straight line to the first houses in the place. These, fenced in by hedges, are in the middle of courtyards full of straggling buildings, wine presses, cart sheds, and distilleries scattered under thick trees, with ladders, poles, or scythes hung onto the branches. The thatched roofs, like fur caps drawn over eyes, reach down over about a third of the low windows, whose coarse convex glasses have knots in the middle like the bottoms of bottles. Against the plaster wall, diagonally crossed by black joists, a meagre pear tree sometimes leans, and the ground floors have at their door a small swing gate to keep out the chicks that come pilfering crumbs of bread steeped in cider on the threshold. But the courtyards grow narrower, the houses closer together, and the fences disappear. A bundle of ferns swings under a window from the end of a broomstick. There is a blacksmith's forge, and then a wheelwright's, with two or three new carts outside that partly block up the way. Then, across an open space, appears a white house beyond a grass mound ornamented by a cupid, his finger on his lips. Two brass vases are at each end of a flight of steps. Scutcheons blaze upon the door. It is the notary's house, and the finest in the place. The church is on the other side of the street, 20 paces farther down, at the entrance of the square. The little cemetery that surrounds it, closed in by a wall breast high, is so full of graves that the old stones, level with the ground, form a continuous pavement on which the grass of itself has marked out regular green squares. The church was rebuilt during the last years of the reign of Charles X. The wooden roof is beginning to rot from the top, and here and there has black hollows in its blue colour. Over the door, where the organ should be, is a loft for the men, with a spiral staircase that reverberates under their wooden shoes. The daylight, coming through the plain glass windows, falls obliquely upon the pews ranged along the walls, which are adorned here and there with a straw mat, bearing beneath it the words in large letters, Mr. So-and-so's pew. Farther on, at a spot where the building narrows, the confessional forms a pendant to a statuette of the Virgin, clothed in a satin robe, coiffed with a tulle veil, sprinkled with silver stars, and with red cheeks like an idol of the Sandwich Islands. And, finally, a copy of the Holy Family, presented by the Minister of the Interior, overlooking the high altar between four candlesticks, closes in the perspective. The choir stalls of deal wood have been left unpainted. The market, that is to say, a tiled roof supported by some 20 posts, occupies of itself about half the public square of Yonville. The town hall, constructed from the designs of a Paris architect, is a sort of Greek temple that forms the corner next to the chemist's shop. On the ground floor are three Ionic columns, and on the first floor a semicircular gallery, while the dome that crowns it is occupied by a Gallic cock, resting one foot upon the chart and holding in the other the scales of justice. But that which most attracts the eye is opposite the Lion Door Inn, the chemist's shop of Monsieur Romay. In the evening especially, its argand lamp is lit up, and the red and green jars that embellish his shop front throw far across the street their two streams of colour. Then, across them, as if in Bengal lights, is seen the shadow of the chemist leaning over his desk. His house, from top to bottom, is placarded with inscriptions, written in large hand, round hand, printed hand, Vichy, seltzer, barrage waters, blood purifiers, Raspail, patent medicine, Arabian Rakahu, Darcet lozenges, Regnault paste, trusses, baths, hygienic chocolate, etc. And the signboard, which takes up all the breadth of the shop, bears in gold letters, Homme, chemist. Then, at the back of the shop, behind the great scales fixed to the counter, the word laboratory appears on a scroll above a glass door, which, about halfway up, once more repeats Homme in gold letters on a black ground. Beyond this, there is nothing to see at Yonville. The street, the only one, a gunshot in length and flanked by a few shops on either side, stops short at the turn of the high road. If it is left on the right hand, and the foot of the Saint-Jean Hills followed, the cemetery is soon reached. At the time of the cholera, in order to enlarge this, a piece of wall was pulled down, and 3 acres of land by its side purchased. But all the new portion is almost tenantless. The tombs, as heretofore, continue to crowd together towards the gate. The keeper, who is at once gravedigger and church beadle, thus making a double profit out of the parish corpses, has taken advantage of the unused plot of ground to plant potatoes there. From year to year, however, his small field grows smaller, and when there is an epidemic, he does not know whether to rejoice at the deaths or regret the burials. "You live on the dead, Lestiboudois," the curé at last said to him one day. This grim remark made him reflect. It checked him for some time, but to this day he carries on the cultivation of his little tubers, and even maintains stoutly that they grow naturally. Since the events about to be narrated, nothing, in fact, has changed at Yonville. The tin tricolour flag still swings at the top of the church steeple. The two chintz streamers still flutter in the wind from the linen drapers. The chemist's foetuses, like lumps of white amadou, rot more and more in their turbid alcohol. And above the big door of the inn, the old golden lion, faded by rain, still shows passers-by its poodle mane. On the evening when the Bovarys were to arrive at Yonville, Widow Lefrancois, the landlady of this inn, was so very busy that she sweated great drops as she moved her saucepans. Tomorrow was market day. The meat had to be cut beforehand, the fowls drawn, the soup and coffee made. Moreover, she had the boarders' meal to see to, and that of the doctor, his wife, and their servant. The billiard room was echoing with bursts of laughter. 3 millers in the small parlour were calling for brandy. The wood was blazing, the brazen pan was hissing, and on the long kitchen table, amid the quarters of raw mutton, rose piles of plates that rattled with the shaking of the block on which spinach was being chopped. From the poultry yard was heard the screaming of the fowls, whom the servant was chasing in order to wring their necks. A man slightly marked with smallpox, in green leather slippers and wearing a velvet cap with a gold tassel, was warming his back at the chimney. His face expressed nothing but self-satisfaction, and he appeared to take life as calmly as the goldfinch suspended over his head in its wicker cage. This was the chemist. "Artemise!" shouted the landlady. "Chop some wood! Fill the water bottles! Bring some brandy! Look sharp! If only I knew what dessert to offer the guests you are expecting! Good heavens! Those furniture movers are beginning their racket in the billiard room again, and their van has been left before the front door. The Hirondelle might run into it when it draws up. Call Polite and tell him to put it up. Only to think, Monsieur Homme, that since morning they've had about 15 games and drunk 8 jars of cider. Why, they'll tear my cloth for me," she went on, looking at them from a distance, her strainer in her hand.
"That wouldn't be much of a loss," replied Monsieur Homme. "You would buy another."
"Another billiard table?" exclaimed the widow.
"Since that one is coming to pieces, Madame Lefrancois, I tell you again, you are doing yourself harm, much harm. And besides, players now want narrow pockets and heavy cues. Hazards aren't played now. Everything is changed. One must keep pace with the times. Just look at Tellier."
The hostess reddened with vexation. The chemist went on.
"You may say what you like. His table is better than yours. And if one were to think, for example, of getting up a patriotic pool for Poland or the sufferers from the Lyon floods—"
"It isn't beggars like him that'll frighten us," interrupted the landlady, shrugging her fat shoulders.
"Come, come, Monsieur Homme,
As long as the Lion d'Or exists, people will come to it. We've feathered our nest. While one of these days you'll find the Café Français closed with a big placard on the shutters. Change my billiard table, she went on, speaking to herself. The table that comes in so handy for folding the washing, and on which in the hunting season I have slept 6 visitors. But that Dord l'Hiver doesn't come. Are you waiting for him for your gentleman's dinner? Wait for him? And what about Monsieur Binet? As the clock strikes 6, you'll see him come in, for he hasn't his equal under the sun for punctuality. He must always have his seat in the small parlour. He'd rather die than dine anywhere else. And so squeamish as he is, and so particular about the cider. Not like Monsieur Léon. He sometimes comes at 7 or even 7:30, and he doesn't so much as look at what he eats. Such a nice young man. Never speaks a rough word. Well, you see, there's a great difference between an educated man and an old carabineer who is now a tax collector. 6 o'clock struck. Binet came in. He wore a blue frock coat falling in a straight line round his thin body, and his leather cap, with its lappets knotted over the top of his head with string, showed under the turned-up peak a bald forehead flattened by the constant wearing of a helmet. He wore a black waistcoat, a hair collar, grey trousers, and all the year round well-blacked boots that had 2 parallel swellings due to the sticking out of his big toes. Not a hair stood out from the regular line of fair whiskers which, encircling his jaws, framed, after the fashion of a garden border, his long, wan face, whose eyes were small and the nose hooked. Clever at all games of cards, a good hunter, and writing a fine hand, he had at home a lathe, and amused himself by turning napkin rings, with which he filled up his house, with the jealousy of an artist and the egotism of a bourgeois. He went to the small parlour, but the 3 millers had to be got out first, and during the whole time necessary for laying the cloth, Binet remained silent in his place near the stove. Then he shut the door and took off his cap in his usual way. "It isn't with saying civil things that he'll wear out his tongue," said the chemist, as soon as he was alone with the landlady. "He never talks more," she replied. "Last week 2 travellers in the cloth line were here, such clever chaps, who told such jokes in the evening that I fairly cried with laughing, and he stood there like a dabfish and never said a word." "Yes," observed the chemist, "no imagination, no sallies, nothing that makes the society man." "Yet they say he has parts," objected the landlady. "Parts," replied Monsieur Homais, "he parts. In his own line it is possible," he added in a calmer tone, and he went on. "That a merchant who has large connections, a jurisconsult, a doctor, a chemist, should be thus absent-minded, that they should become whimsical or even peevish, I can understand. Such cases are cited in history, but at least it is because they are thinking of something. Myself, for example, how often has it happened to me to look on the bureau for my pen to write a label and to find after all that I had put it behind my ear?" Madame Lefrancois just then went to the door to see if the Hirondelle were not coming. She started. A man dressed in black suddenly came into the kitchen. By the last gleam of the twilight one could see that his face was rubicund and his form athletic. "What can I do for you, Monsieur le Curé?" asked the landlady, as she reached down from the chimney one of the copper candlesticks, placed with their candles in a row. "Will you take something? A thimbleful of cassis? A glass of wine?" The priest declined very politely. He had come for his umbrella, that he had forgotten the other day at the Ennemont convent, and after asking Madame Lefrancois to have it sent to him at the presbytery in the evening, he left for the church from which the Angelus was ringing. When the chemist no longer heard the noise of his boots along the square, he thought the priest's behaviour just now very unbecoming. This refusal to take any refreshment seemed to him the most odious hypocrisy. All priests tippled on the sly and were trying to bring back the days of the tithe. The landlady took up the defence of her curé. "Besides, he could double up 4 men like you over his knee. Last year he helped our people to bring in the straw. He carried as many as 6 trusses at once, he is so strong." "Bravo," said the chemist. "Now just send your daughters to confess to fellows with such a temperament. If I were the government, I'd have the priest bled once a month." Yes, Madame Lefrancois, every month. A good phlebotomy in the interest of the police and morals. Be quiet, Monsieur Homais. You are an infidel. You've no religion. The chemist answered, I have a religion, my religion, and I even have more than all these others with their mummeries and their juggling. I adore God, on the contrary. I believe in the supreme being, in a creator, whatever he may be. I care little who has placed us here below to fulfil our duties as citizens and fathers of families. But I don't need to go to church to kiss silver plates and fatten out of my pocket a lot of good-for-nothings who live better than we do. For one can know him as well in a wood, in a field, or even contemplating the eternal vault like the ancients. My God, mine is the God of Socrates, of Franklin, of Voltaire, and of Béranger. I am for the profession of faith of the Savoyard vicar and the immortal principles of 89. And I can't admit of an old boy of a God who takes walks in his garden with a cane in his hand, who lodges his friends in the belly of whales, dies uttering a cry, and rises again at the end of 3 days. Things absurd in themselves and completely opposed, moreover, to all physical laws. Which proves to us, by the way, that priests have always wallowed in turpid ignorance, in which they would fain engulf the people with them. He ceased, looking round for an audience, for in his bubbling over the chemist had for a moment fancied himself in the midst of the town council. But the landlady no longer heeded him. She was listening to a distant rolling. One could distinguish the noise of a carriage, mingled with the clattering of loose horseshoes that beat against the ground, and at last the Hirondelle stopped at the door. It was a yellow box on two large wheels that, reaching to the tilt, prevented travellers from seeing the road and dirtied their shoulders. The small panes of the narrow windows rattled in their sashes when the coach was closed, and retained here and there patches of mud amid the old layers of dust that not even storms of rain had altogether washed away. It was drawn by three horses, the first a leader, and when it came downhill its bottom jolted against the ground. Some of the inhabitants of Yonville came out into the square. They all spoke at once, asking for news, for explanations, for hampers. Hivert did not know whom to answer. It was he who did the errands of the place in town. He went to the shops and brought back rolls of leather for the shoemaker, old iron for the farrier, a barrel of herrings for his mistress, caps from the milliners, locks from the hairdressers, and all along the road on his return journey he distributed his parcels, which he threw, standing upright on his seat and shouting at the top of his voice over the enclosures of the yards. An accident had delayed him. Madame Bovary's greyhound had run across the field. They had whistled for him a quarter of an hour. Hivert had even gone back a mile and a half, expecting every moment to catch sight of her, but it had been necessary to go on. Emma had wept, grown angry. She had accused Charles of this misfortune. Monsieur Lheureux, a draper who happened to be in the coach with her, had tried to console her by a number of examples of lost dogs recognising their masters at the end of long years. One, he said, had been told of, who had come back to Paris from Constantinople. Another had gone 150 miles in a straight line and swum four rivers, and his own father had possessed a poodle, which, after 12 years of absence, had all of a sudden jumped on his back in the street as he was going to dine in town. Chapter 2 Emma got out first, then Felicity, Monsieur Lheureux, and a nurse, and they had to wake up Charles in his corner, where he had slept soundly since night set in. Homais introduced himself. He offered his homages to Madame and his respects to Monsieur, said he was charmed to have been able to render them some slight service, and added with a cordial air that he had ventured to invite himself, his wife being away. When Madame Bovary was in the kitchen, she went up to the chimney. With the tips of her fingers she caught her dress at the knee, and having thus pulled it up to her ankle, held out her foot in its black boot to the fire above the revolving leg of mutton. The flame lit up the whole of her. A great red glow passed over her with the blowing of the wind through the half-open door. On the other side of the chimney a young man with fair hair watched her silently. As he was a good deal bored at Yonville, where he was a clerk at the notary's, Monsieur Guillaumin, Monsieur Léon Dupuis, it was he who was the second habitué of the Lion d'Or, frequently put back his dinner hour, in the hope that some traveller might come to the inn with whom he could chat in the evening. On the days when his work was done early, he had, for want of something else to do, to come punctually and endure from soup to cheese a tête-à-tête with Binet. It was therefore with delight that he accepted the landlady's suggestion that he should dine in company with the newcomers, and they passed into the large parlour, where Madame Lefrançois, for the purpose of showing off, had had the table laid for four. Homais asked to be allowed to keep on his skull-cap for fear of coryza. Then, turning to his neighbour, "Madame is no doubt a little fatigued. One gets jolted so abominably in our hirondelle."
"That is true," replied Emma, "but moving about always amuses me. I like change of place."
"It is so tedious," sighed the clerk, "to be always riveted to the same places." "If you are like me," said Charles, "constantly obliged to be in the saddle." "But," Léon went on, addressing himself to Madame Bovary, "nothing, it seems to me, is more pleasant, when one can," he added. "Moreover," said the druggist, "the practice of medicine is not very hard work in our part of the world, for the state of our roads allows us the use of gigs, and generally, as the farmers are well off, they pay pretty well. We have, medically speaking, besides the ordinary cases of enteritis, bronchitis, bilious affections, and so on, now and then a few intermittent fevers at harvest time, but on the whole little of a serious nature. Nothing special to note, unless it be a great deal of scrofula, due no doubt to the deplorable hygienic conditions of our peasant dwellings. Ah, you will find many prejudices to combat, Monsieur Bovary, much obstinacy of routine, with which all the efforts of your science will daily come into collision, for people still have recourse to novenas, to relics, to the priest, rather than come straight to the doctor or the chemist. The climate, however, is not, truth to tell, bad, and we even have a few nonagenarians in our parish. The thermometer, I have made some observations, falls in winter to 4 degrees, and in the hottest season rises to 25 or 30 degrees centigrade at the outside, which gives us 24 degrees Réaumur as the maximum, or otherwise 54 degrees Fahrenheit, English scale, not more. And as a matter of fact, we are sheltered from the north winds by the forest of Argueil on the one side, from the west winds by the Saint-Jean range on the other, and this heat, moreover, which, on account of the aqueous vapours given off by the river and the considerable number of cattle in the fields, which, as you know, exhale much ammonia, that is to say nitrogen, hydrogen, and oxygen, no, nitrogen and hydrogen alone, and which, sucking up into itself the humus from the ground, mixing together all those different emanations, unites them into a stack, so to say, and, combining with the electricity diffused through the atmosphere, when there is any, might in the long run, as in any tropical countries, engender insalubrious miasmata. This heat, I say, finds itself perfectly tempered on the side whence it comes, or rather whence it should come, that is to say the southern side, by the southeastern winds, which, having cooled themselves, passing over the Seine, reach us sometimes all at once like breezes from Russia.
"At any rate you have some walks in the neighbourhood," continued Madame Bovary, speaking to the young man.
"Oh, very few," he answered. "There is a place they call La Pâture on the top of the hill, on the edge of the forest. Sometimes on Sundays I go and stay there with a book, watching the sunset."
"I think there is nothing so admirable as sunsets," she resumed, "but especially by the side of the sea."
"Oh, I adore the sea," said Monsieur Léon.
"And then, does it not seem to you," continued Madame Bovary, "that the mind travels more freely on this limitless expanse, the contemplation of which elevates the soul, gives ideas of the infinite, the ideal?"
"It is the same with mountainous landscapes," continued Léon. "A cousin of mine who travelled in Switzerland last year told me that one could not picture to oneself the poetry of the lakes, the charm of the waterfalls, the gigantic effect of the glaciers. One sees pines of incredible size across torrents, cottages suspended over precipices, and 1,000 feet below one, whole valleys when the clouds open. Such spectacles must stir to enthusiasm, incline to prayer, to ecstasy. And I no longer marvel at that celebrated musician who, the better to inspire his imagination, was in the habit of playing the piano before some imposing sight."
"You play?" she asked.
"No, but I'm very fond of music," he replied. "Ha-ha! Don't you listen to him, Madame Bovary," interrupted Homais, bending over his plate. "That sheer modesty! Why, my dear fellow, the other day in your room you were singing L'Ange Gardien ravishingly,
I heard you from the laboratory. You gave it like an actor."
Léon, in fact, lodged at the chemist's, where he had a small room on the second floor overlooking the Place. He blushed at the compliment of his landlord, who had already turned to the doctor, and was enumerating to him, one after the other, all the principal inhabitants of Yonville. He was telling anecdotes, giving information, and the fortune of the notary was not known exactly, and there was the Tuvache household, who made a good deal of show. Emma continued, "And what music do you prefer?"
"Oh, German music, that which makes you dream."
"Have you been to the opera?"
"Not yet, but I shall go next year when I am living at Paris to finish reading for the bar."
"As I had the honour of putting it to your husband," said the chemist, "with regard to this poor Yanoda who has run away, you will find yourself, thanks to his extravagance, in the possession of one of the most comfortable houses of Yonville. Its greatest convenience for a doctor is a door giving on the walk, where one can go in and out unseen. Moreover, it contains everything that is agreeable in a household, a laundry, kitchen with offices, sitting room, fruit room, and so on. He was a gay dog who didn't care what he spent. At the end of the garden, by the side of the water, he had an arbour built, just for the purpose of drinking beer in summer, and if Madame is fond of gardening, she will be able—"
"My wife doesn't care about it," said Charles. "Although she has been advised to take exercise, she prefers always sitting in her room, reading."
"Like me," replied Léon. "And indeed, what is better than to sit by one's fireside in the evening with a book, while the wind beats against the window and the lamp is burning?" "What indeed?" she said, fixing her large black eyes wide open upon him.
"One thinks of nothing," he continued. "The hours slip by. Motionless we traverse countries we fancy we see, and your thought, blending with the fiction, playing with the details, follows the outline of the adventures. It mingles with the characters, and it seems as if it were yourself, palpitating beneath their costumes."
"That is true, that is true," she said. "Has it ever happened to you," Léon went on, "to come across some vague idea of one's own in a book, some dim image that comes back to you from afar, and is the completest expression of your own slightest sentiment?"
"I have experienced it," she replied. "That is why," he said, "I especially love the poets. I think verse more tender than prose, and that it moves far more easily to tears."
"Still, in the long run, it is tiring," continued Emma. "Now, I, on the contrary, adore stories that rush breathlessly along, that frighten one. I detest commonplace heroes and moderate sentiments such as there are in nature."
"In fact," observed the clerk, "these works, not touching the heart, miss, it seems to me, the true end of art. It is so sweet amid all the disenchantments of life to be able to dwell in thought upon noble characters, pure affections, and pictures of happiness. For myself, living here far from the world, this is my one distraction, but Yonville affords so few resources."
"Like Tosters, no doubt," replied Emma, "and so I always subscribe to a lending library."
"If Madame will do me the honour of making use of it," said the chemist, who had just caught the last words, "I have at her disposal a library composed of the best authors, Voltaire, Rousseau, Delille, Walter Scott, the Echo des Feuilletons, and in addition I receive various periodicals, among them the Fanal de Rouen daily, having the advantage to be its correspondent for the districts of Bugy, Forges, Neufchâtel, Yonville, and vicinity."
For 2.5 hours they had been at table, for the servant, Artemise, carelessly dragging her old list slippers over the flags, brought one plate after the other, forgot everything, and constantly left the door of the billiard room half open so that it beat against the wall with its hooks. Unconsciously, Léon, while talking, had placed his foot on one of the bars of the chair on which Madame Bovary was sitting. She wore a small blue silk necktie that kept up like a ruff a gauffered cambric collar, and with the movements of her head, the lower part of her face gently sunk into the linen or came out from it. Thus, side by side, while Charles and the chemist chatted, they entered into one of those vague conversations where the hazard of all that is said brings you back to the fixed centre of a common sympathy. The Paris theatres, titles of novels, new quadrilles, and the world they did not know. Tosters, where she had lived, and Yonville, where they were. They examined all, talked of everything till the end of dinner. When coffee was served, Felicity went away to get ready the room in the new house, and the guests soon raised the siege. Madame Lefrancois was asleep near the cinders, while the stable-boy, lantern in hand, was waiting to show Monsieur and Madame Bovary the way home. Bits of straw stuck in his red hair, and he limped with his left leg. When he had taken in his other hand the curé's umbrella, they started. The town was asleep. The pillars of the market threw great shadows. The earth was all grey as on a summer's night. But as the doctor's house was only some 50 paces from the inn, they had to say good night almost immediately, and the company dispersed. As soon as she entered the passage, Emma felt the cold of the plaster fall about her shoulders like damp linen. The walls were new, and the wooden stairs creaked. In their bedroom on the first floor, a whitish light passed through the curtainless windows. She could catch glimpses of treetops, and beyond, the fields, half drowned in the fog that lay reeking in the moonlight along the course of the river. In the middle of the room, pell-mell, were scattered drawers, bottles, curtain rods, gilt poles, with mattresses on the chairs and basins on the ground. The two men who had brought the furniture had left everything about carelessly. This was the fourth time that she had slept in a strange place. The first was the day of her going to the convent, the second of her arrival at Tostes, the third at Vaubyessard, and this was the fourth. And each one had marked, as it were, the inauguration of a new phase in her life. She did not believe that things could present themselves in the same way in different places, and since the portion of her life lived had been bad, no doubt that which remained to be lived would be better. Chapter 3. The next day, as she was getting up, she saw the clerk on the Place. She had on a dressing gown. He looked up and bowed. She nodded quickly and reclosed the window. Léon waited all day for 6 o'clock in the evening to come. But on going to the inn, he found no one but Monsieur Binet already at table. The dinner of the evening before had been a considerable event for him. He had never till then talked for 2 hours consecutively to a lady. How then had he been able to explain, and in such language, the number of things that he could not have said so well before? He was usually shy, and maintained that reserve which partakes at once of modesty and dissimulation. At Yonville he was considered well-bred. He listened to the arguments of the older people, and did not seem hot about politics, a remarkable thing for a young man. Then he had some accomplishments. He painted in watercolours, could read the key of G, and readily talked literature after dinner when he did not play cards. Monsieur Homais respected him for his education. Madame Homais liked him for his good nature, for he often took the little Homais into the garden, little brats who were always dirty, very much spoilt, and somewhat lymphatic, like their mother. Besides the servant to look after them, they had Justin, the chemist's apprentice, a second cousin of Monsieur Homais, who had been taken into the house from charity, and who was useful at the same time as a servant. The druggist proved the best of neighbours. He gave Madame Bovary information as to the tradespeople, sent expressly for his own cider merchant, tasted the drink himself, and saw that the casks were properly placed in the cellar. He explained how to set about getting in a supply of butter cheap, and made an arrangement with Lestiboudois, the sacristan, who, besides his sacerdotal and funereal functions, looked after the principal gardens at Yonville by the hour or the year, according to the taste of the customers. The need of looking after others was not the only thing that urged the chemist to such obsequious cordiality. There was a plan underneath it all. He had infringed the law of the 19th Ventose, Year 11, Article 1, which forbade all persons not having a diploma to practice medicine, so that after certain anonymous denunciations, Homais had been summoned to Rouen to see the procureur of the king in his own private room. The magistrate, receiving him standing up, ermine on shoulder and cap on head. It was in the morning before the court opened. In the corridors one heard the heavy boots of the gendarmes walking past, and like a far-off noise great locks that were shut. The druggist's ears tingled as if he were about to have an apoplectic stroke. He saw the depths of dungeons, his family in tears, his shop sold, all the jars dispersed, and he was obliged to enter a café and take a glass of rum and seltzer to recover his spirits. Little by little the memory of this reprimand grew fainter, and he continued as heretofore to give anodyne consultations in his back parlour. But the mayor resented it, his colleagues were jealous, everything was to be feared. Gaining over Monsieur Bovary by his attentions was to earn his gratitude and prevent his speaking out later on should he notice anything. So every morning Homais brought him the paper, and often in the afternoon left his shop for a few moments to have a chat with the doctor. Charles was dull. Patience did not come. He remained seated for hours without speaking, went into his consulting room to sleep, or watched his wife sewing. Then, for diversion, he employed himself at home as a workman. He even tried to do up the attic with some paint which had been left behind by the painters, but money matters worried him. He had spent so much for repairs at Tosters, for Madame's toilet and for the moving, that the whole dowry, over 3,000 crowns, had slipped away in 2 years. Then how many things had been spoilt or lost during their carriage from Tosters to Yonville? Without counting the plaster curé, who, falling out of the coach at an over-severe jolt, had been dashed into 1,000 fragments on the pavement of Quincampoix. A pleasanter trouble came to distract him, namely the pregnancy of his wife. As the time of her confinement approached, he cherished her the more. It was another bond of the flesh establishing itself, and, as it were, a continued sentiment of a more complex union. When, from afar, he saw her languid walk, and her figure without stays, turning softly on her hips. When, opposite one another, he looked at her at his ease, while she took tired poses in her armchair, then his happiness knew no bounds. He got up, embraced her, passed his hands over her face, called her little mamma, wanted to make her dance, and half laughing, half crying, uttered all kinds of caressing pleasantries that came into his head. The idea of having begotten a child delighted him. Now he wanted nothing. He knew human life from end to end, and he sat down to it with serenity. Emma at first felt a great astonishment, then was anxious to be delivered, that she might know what it was to be a mother. But not being able to spend as much as she would have liked, to have a swing bassinet with rose silk curtains and embroidered caps, in a fit of bitterness she gave up looking after the trousseau and ordered the whole of it from a village needlewoman without choosing or discussing anything. Thus she did not amuse herself with those preparations that stimulate the tenderness of mothers, and so her affection was from the very outset, perhaps to some extent, attenuated. As Charles, however, spoke of the boy at every meal, she soon began to think of him more consecutively. She hoped for a son. He would be strong and dark. She would call him Georges. And this idea of having a male child was like an expected revenge for all her impotence in the past. A man, at least, is free. He may travel over passions and over countries, overcome obstacles, taste of the most far-away pleasures. But a woman is always hampered. At once inert and flexible, she has against her the weakness of the flesh and legal dependence. Her will, like the veil of her bonnet, held by a string, flutters in every wind. There is always some desire that draws her, some conventionality that restrains. She was confined on a Sunday at about 6 o'clock, as the sun was rising. "It is a girl," said Charles. She turned her head away and fainted. Madame Homais, as well as Madame Lefrancois of the Lion d'Or, almost immediately came running in to embrace her. The chemist, as a man of discretion, only offered a few provisional felicitations through the half-open door. He wished to see the child, and thought it well made. Whilst she was getting well, she occupied herself much in seeking a name for her daughter. First she went over all those that have Italian endings, such as Clara, Louisa, Amanda, Atala. She liked Gulcinda pretty well, and Isolt or Leocadi still better. Charles wanted the child to be called after her mother. Emma opposed this. They ran over the calendar from end to end, and then consulted outsiders. "Monsieur Léon," said the chemist, with whom I was talking about it the other day, "wonders you do not choose Madeleine. 'Tis very much in fashion just now." But Madame Bovary senior cried out loudly against this name of a sinner. As to Monsieur Homais, he had a preference for all those that recalled some great man, an illustrious fact, or a generous idea, and it was on this system that he had baptized his 4 children, Thus Napoleon represented glory and Franklin liberty. Irma was perhaps a concession to romanticism, but Athalie was a homage to the greatest masterpiece of the French stage. For his philosophical convictions did not interfere with his artistic tastes. In him the thinker did not stifle the man of sentiment. He could make distinctions, make allowances for imagination and fanaticism.